This has really got two parts to it. One part is substantive, as in what does the Digital Economy Bill do? What laws does it pass? And it has now passed, so it will be coming into law. But the second part, which may or may not be of more interest, is it's a general point about the process of the passing of this law through Parliament and how it was seen from outside, particularly via social media, such as blogs and Twitter especially. And I'm kind of a participant reporter, almost a sort of participant anthropologist. And it was a very interesting process, and I think it does say some interesting things about what the possible shape of future politics might be, especially as we go into the election. So it's all quite topical. Well, I'll start with the substantive part, okay? And really, it's up to you guys. You could indicate if you want me to do more on that or less on the democracy part or whatever. All right? So the quote from the title is often attributed to Bismarck, but actually, if you look at Wikipedia, there seem to be lots of other people who've made this comment. It's perhaps quite an obvious comment. I have paraphrased here. There are two things you never want to see being made, law and sausages. And having just spent the last 4 or 5 months watching a law being made, I agree with this quote enormously. Don't do this at home, kids. It will destroy your faith in democracy and make you, as I am now, a complete champion of the House of Lords and pretty unconvinced of representational democracy. And I teach law. Be very afraid. Okay, so the substantive part. I imagine, is there anyone in this room who's never even heard of Three Strikes? Just wandered into this room by accident, thinking it was a talk about bovine swine flu.
Well, I'm American, so in America it means you go to jail if you...
Yeah, it doesn't mean that. Good point. Okay. Right, from the top, right? Okay, there is this concept that has been prevalent in kind of legislative and copyright circles for a while. Basically, the copyright industries, by which I mean the content industries like the music industry, the film industry, the games industry, the software industry, have been facing a crisis since the invention really of the digital economy, the digitization. Okay? This has been aggravated by the development of things like peer-to-peer networks, which make file sharing very, very easy. By the invention, obviously, of the internet, which makes transmission of files globally and across borders very, very easy. And the debate is really around the fact that if these economies, music, film, video, that were based on selling hard copies, are no longer succeeding in doing that. And they're having to face the challenge of the fact that if everyone can make perfect copies very, very easily, will anyone pay for those copies? Especially when you can swap them, share them via these networks, yeah? So that's really what the debate is about. And that's what I've tried to emphasise here. This is a very long-running debate. It's been running at least since the commercialisation of the internet in 96. It's definitely been top of the agenda for the music and the film industries since Napster came along in about 2000, about the time of the dot-com boom. It's been debated in legal circles, particularly in this country. We have something called the Gowers Report on Intellectual Property. Oh, I look fabulous. And that came up with some reasonably interesting suggestions about how to reform the intellectual property, the copyright system. It said very little about file sharing, actually. There was only one recommendation in the Gowers Report that said anything about file sharing, and it just sort of said, well, we should do something about this, probably. That was recommendation 39. However, and this is where you move to the campaigning, the agitprop. Gower has been invoked time and time again by the music industries to say, oh, this has been on the agenda for change for this long. So it's a highly polarised debate, I think you could say. We've, on the one hand, understandably, the existing content industries, music, film, etc., fighting for their lives, basically. I mean, you can't have failed to notice, I think, that the record shops are disappearing from our high streets, yeah? HMV has gone, that one with a funny name beginning with Z has gone. What was it? Zazzy, something like that. Yeah? Shortly, Blockbusters is going to go. I think it's just gone bust, hasn't it?
Should have done.
On the other hand, right, this to me, this middle block, is what the debate should be about. Okay, the content industries have a right to make profits. They employ people, they create wealth. Very few people I know deny that. Similarly, very, very, very few people, I think, certainly none I know, deny that artists, by which I mean musicians, filmmakers, etc., etc., have a right to be compensated for their work, for the labours of their skin, the sweat of their brow, etc., etc. So the question becomes, in a world of easy, perfect copying for free, how should artists get money? Because the current system isn't working. The current system just makes it too easy to make copies, and that is leading to a normalisation of making copies for free for almost anyone in this audience, I imagine, under about 25. When did you last pay for a CD? Don't answer that question. So these are the big questions. How are the artists to get money? Now, there are alternatives to selling copies, which isn't working. CF, the disappearance of HMP. One, for example, that's been very detailedly worked out by a number of very interesting academics is the idea of a flat rate levy scheme. You know, so maybe you pay 20 quid a year on your broadband bill, and that money would be divvied up between the artists. Much easier. No going after file sharers, no disconnections, no trying to sue people, sue grandmothers, etc. There are alternative ways. So there is a whole field of looking at what's sometimes called alternative compensation schemes. Okay? How are the intermediaries, that's the record companies, the film companies, the record shops, etc., to reframe their business models to deal with this scenario? And one of the underlying issues here, again, trying to put this even-handedly, is that some would say that the problem is that these industries don't want to reframe their business models. They want to sit where they are, making lots of money. Wouldn't you? I would. The fact is that they made enormous profits in the 80s because that was the switchover, particularly in the music industry, in formats from vinyl to CD, where everyone went out and replaced their entire Beatles collection by buying it on CD. Similar things then happened with DVDs, Blu-ray, etc., etc. It could be argued that the hunt for the profits of the 80s is a chimera, because that will never happen again. So these are all examples of what's going on here. That again, there is an entire field of discussion here in the debate about how should the intermediaries look to make profits now? Should they make the stuff freely available and sell ads around the content, as people like Last.fm do, or Spotify was trying to do? Should they disintermediate entirely? Is it in fact that the record industry has become a dinosaur? And what we'll see is artists selling their stuff directly over the internet to their punters, which, as I'm sure we all know, our favourite example, quite a lot of bands are doing. I think that's famously, isn't it, how the Arctic Monkeys started off. And there are a number of bands or artists who have deserted their record labels and are selling directly over the internet. So the third point, and I think it is the third point here, I think these first two points are by far the more important ones to be debated in Parliament and elsewhere. The third point is, given where we are right now, in this transitional point between business models, between the analogue economy and the digital economy, how do we deal right now with the fact that this industry is struggling? And that's really what it comes down to. We've got a blip situation where the current record, film, game and software industries, less so the software industry, want to be protected right now from copyright infringement. Again, fair enough. As a lawyer, I can't gainsay that. I believe in upholding the law. But the question then is, how do you do it, right? Obviously, you can stop people file sharing if you threaten them with death if they do it. That probably isn't a sensible or proportionate response, right? So the question is where to strike the balance between disincentivizing infringement and respecting basic human rights. Now, this debate came to a crunch in the Digital Economy Bill, as you'll see in the next slide, where some lawyers, including me, it has to be said, felt that the proposals, the three strikes proposals, which I will eventually get to, probably infringe a number of human rights in a disproportionate way, considering the target of disincentivizing file sharing. Okay? So this at the bottom, I'm afraid falling off the bottom of the page, what the debate is not about. Now this is bringing into focus, I think, that this is not just the legal talk, right? Because I doubt so many would come here if this was just the dry legal talk. This is also a politics talk and a campaigning talk. And the music industry, fighting for their lives, as I say, have very cleverly spent a great deal of money and hired some very clever people to construct this debate, one might say, in socio-discourse talk, to say that actually what the debate is about is saying that musicians should be ripped off, that piracy is good, that artists should be spat on. And in a slightly more educated way, that the debate is about abolishing the whole idea of copyright, of intellectual property law, of returns to artists for their work. The debate is not about that. There is a very small number of people, not even most of the people in the Pirate Party, which is something of a joke name really, who believe in either of these points. The debate, as I say, is really in this middle ground. But that is not cleverly how it's been framed by the music industry in this country. And that affected the progress of the Digital Economy Bill through the House of Lords and the House of Commons a great deal, right? So that's the second bit I want to come to. Okay. So, substantive issues. This is where I got involved. Contrary to some of the press around this, I got involved not because I was a copyright abolitionist, or indeed because I was very interested in copyright at all, because I wasn't. I got involved because since about 1997, I've been writing about ISPs, about internet service providers, as the vital intermediaries of the internet, the people who provide access to the internet, the gatekeepers of the internet. And I've been very interested since, as I said, about 97, in how far and whether you should hold ISPs responsible for the content that they transmit or distribute. So in the very early days of the internet, you saw ISPs being held liable for distributing child porn, for example, just because they were the people giving access to it. And very early on in the development of the internet, a sort of consensus grew up that this was not a sensible way to proceed, that ISPs could not be held liable for all the content that they gave access to or distributed, because then the internet would collapse, right? So that was my interest. Then along came the Digital Economy Bill, and the world was warped to some extent by the copyright wars that I tried to outline over the page. The Digital Economy Bill is an example of what I was calling three strikes. This is an idea that came originally from the French, not the Americans, in which the idea was that people who were alleged to be file sharers would get a strike against them for every act of file sharing, and if they got three, they would be disconnected from the internet. That was the idea, as opposed to sent to jail, which is what Radio 2 said, but that was wrong. So the Digital Economy Bill kind of adopted the French model, which has passed in France, although it's been knocked down as unconstitutional twice, but it keeps coming back from the dead with slight tweaks. That's dopey. Here, the Digital Economy Bill, it should be said, is a very wide bill, lest you be coming from another angle and wondering about this. It's a very wide bill, including all sorts of stuff from how to reform Channel 4 to how to review the remit of Ofcom, etc., etc. But the bit that I'm interested in, and that I hope you're interested in, are these two points up here, which is that they had a section that was basically meant to bring in a system of, unquote, three strikes, though it didn't involve three or strikes, in which the music industry would basically pass notifications that someone was suspected of being a file sharer, identified only by their IP address, to the ISPs, who would collect these warnings, relate them to who the subscriber really was, send out warnings to that person, and when a certain indeterminate number of these warnings had been amassed, which is yet another point that was never really dealt with much in the debate, but it was as long as a piece of string as you look at the section, when enough of these warnings had maybe been amassed, then possibly we would move on to stage two of the Digital Economy Bill, which would involve applying technical measures. Now, again, what that means has changed throughout the progress of the legislation, but to start with, at least, it pretty much seemed to mean disconnection. Later on, they finessed it a bit, and it seems also now perhaps to involve slowing down your traffic to the point where, you know, the internet would flow so slowly for you that you would barely be able to send an email, let alone download a film, right? So the idea would be you get strikes, when you've got enough strikes, they keep warning you, when you've got enough strikes, they cut off your internet, okay? And the idea of this is that it would stop people file sharing, okay? looks good for the music industry, yeah? I'll come back to the second point. But the legal issues, as I say, the bill itself was almost impossible to understand, which raises issues of kind of democracy to start with. It was legislation by reference. In other words, it didn't tell a whole story. It just put bits of the story into other acts. Yeah, so you really couldn't understand it unless you were already a lawyer, and probably at that an IT lawyer or a copyright lawyer. It also left almost all of the detail, and the devil is very much in the detail with this bill, to codes and secondary legislation and things like that. So again, you couldn't tell really how any of this would work because you didn't know, and you had to take it on faith because the government kept telling you that they would do the right thing when they drafted the code. But that was a big taking on faith, because one of the notable features of this process is that there's been almost no involvement from consumer rights organisations or user organisations. It's been driven very much by industry, by the music industry, film industry, etc. So having faith in the code to be fair and even-handed was something that I found a bit difficult to swallow. What were the issues? The issues of what I've just outlined, very briefly, you can try not to get too legalistic, okay? Firstly, as you've seen, this is basically guilt by accusation. Guilt is the wrong word to use because we're not talking about criminal sanctions, but that's the general idea, okay? So the idea is the music industry would accuse, the ISP is a piggy in the middle and they have to kind of launder it and perform the sanction, not the sentence because it's not criminal, but the sanction of eventually cutting people off or maybe slowing their internet down, right? This does not go near a court until the user gets wind of it and says, hang on, it wasn't me, I didn't do this, I'm a 90-year-old grandmother in Berkshire and I've never downloaded in my life. And then they would have to appeal, right? Now, the format of that appeal is still unknown. How much you'd have to pay for it is still unknown. Whether you'd get legal aid for it is still unknown. How you would oppose technical evidence is still unknown. To me, as a lawyer, this is lacking, as they say, seriously in due process. Generally speaking, when we do something as draconian in the modern day as disconnect someone's internet access, we do it by order of a court, right? And one of the interesting little side pieces of information on this is that even in the criminal courts, when they've been sentenced and convicted paedophiles, they have been very, very reluctant to make orders disconnecting from the internet or banning them from the internet, because it is seen as a very important piece of access to knowledge, to services, to communication. Second point that I already alluded to is whether this sanction of disconnection or traffic slowing, which comes to very much the same thing, whether it's proportional. As I've tried to stress, I am not objecting to the enforcement of copyright. There are ways to enforce copyright right now. You sue people in the civil court. If they refuse to defend themselves, they get default judgment against them. That's what ACS law does right now. Okay? So means exist to enforce copyright. The question is whether this sanction of disconnection or traffic slowing was proportionate to the goal of maintaining the enforcement of intellectual property rights mainly for record companies, mainly not even for artists, but for intermediaries. And the issues there, as I think you can guess, are, you know, what are the knock-on effects of disconnection? Well, it might interfere with your freedom of speech. Many, many people express themselves nowadays most volubly via the internet. It might interfere with your freedom of association, all the people talking to each other on Twitter and Facebook and blogs and groups and campaign groups and all the rest of it. It might interfere with your work. There's a very large number of people in this country now who need access to the internet, you know, a vital thing for their work. People, teleworkers, home workers, software workers, etc. Education, I suspect there's quite a few students in this room who really couldn't complete their degree without having access to the internet now. What else have I got? E-government, yes. One of the interesting parts of this is at exactly the same time that this piece of legislation was going through, whose aim was potentially to disconnect up to 7 million file sharers in this country, because that's the figure the BPI keeps quoting, many of whom are young and in education. At the same time as that, Gordon Brown was going on about how access to the internet was absolutely crucial because we needed it to roll out e-government to people and services, like doing their taxes online and claiming their benefit online and all the rest of it. Yeah. So there is a real disconnect there between, on the one hand, saying everyone's got to be digital citizens, and on the other hand, saying unless you've downloaded 3 copies of Britney Spears songs. Yeah. That's where proportionality comes in. Third point, collective punishment. This is generally seen as a no-no, according to the European Convention on Human Rights. The basic point here is that the Act applies punishments or sanctions to the subscriber, unquote. Yeah? Because the way the internet works is if you track an IP address, it tells you who is the subscriber on that particular ISP. It never tells you who was using the computer at that moment. Right, so if you take the typical household, well, not typical household nowadays, actually atypical household, because the typical household in the UK is now a single person, which no one ever knows. But if you took the nuclear family model, you might have one person whose name is the subscriber, the account holder, and say 2 kids, one wife or husband, friends passing through, a Wi-Fi network which all the kids let their friends use when they're there and playing around, etc., etc. So any of these people might download, and the result might be disconnection for the subscriber. But that's collective punishment. You're not actually punishing the person who did it, nor is there really any way to establish who did it. Okay? So again, if you look at the knock-on consequences, you might have, and this is what people typically say, the mum or dad not being able to work as a tele worker because the internet's been disconnected because of the kids downloading. But actually, it's just as likely, if you look at the stats, that the mum and dad might be downloading, and therefore the internet connection is lost, and that means the kids can't do their university homework. Right? So it cuts both ways. But basically, collective punishment, not a very good idea. And then you get to these, which I've called unintended consequences. This is one of the great tropes of legislation, of lawmaking, is that when people make laws without thinking about it very hard, or if they're pursuing a particular agenda, there are often unintended consequences which make it bad news. The reason I put it like that is because these have to be intended consequences by now, because people like me wrote a lot about it, and still it continued. So one of the most noticeable is what I've called the death of public Wi-Fi. And the issue here, again, if you go back to my previous point about how the legislation refers to subscribers, it also refers, because otherwise the law would be very difficult to evade, to either subscribers actually infringing copyright or to subscribers allowing others to use their internet connection to infringe copyright. Yeah? Now that could mean, I noticed when I came in today that the showroom has got unsecured Wi-Fi. Yeah? How many people were sitting in the bar using the unsecured Wi-Fi, right? So,
I downloaded your PowerPoint presentation.
Indeed, and if you downloaded my PowerPoint presentation, there's probably enough bandwidth there for you to download MP3s, in fact. So, supposing the showroom has 3 or 4 or 5 people who download a Britney Spears song, the warnings come in, and then the showroom gets disconnected from the internet. Now, that might not sound so bad, but if you took it to a university network, a library, a community centre, a small business, then this becomes quite problematic. And there is this kind of policy issue about, don't we want to roll out free open public Wi-Fi networks? Isn't this the sign of the modern energised, digitised society where people can participate all the time? I mean, I went to Israel recently. In Israel, there is free Wi-Fi everywhere. And it's tremendously empowering. You can sit down anywhere, download your email, whatever. I don't know whether it's because they're not making profits or what, it's like that. And there is this digital exclusion point that indeed one of the purposes, and this is why the US has just put out a big announcement saying it's going to roll out free public Wi-Fi, free public broadband, is that this is the way to create digital citizenship and to give people opportunities and access to knowledge so as to bring the underclass up with the rest of us. I think I can use us for this room. Yeah. So there is this idea of empowerment by digital inclusion, which this bill seems to run completely counter to. And here indeed, here is my quote. Here is Gordon Brown, who came out with this. Someone pointed this out helpfully to me. In a speech at exactly the moment that the digital economy bill was going through, I think, its second reading. And this is what Gordon Brown said about people who did not have access to the internet. He said that they were trapped in a second tier of citizenship, denied what I increasingly think of as a fundamental freedom in the modern world, to be part of the internet and the technology revolution. Except that he was just about to sign off on legislation which would indeed deny people that right because, say, they downloaded three songs. Does that seem proportionate? Does it seem advisable? Okay. I know I'm probably over time. Can I have 5-10 minutes to talk about the democratic deficit bit? I mean, say if people want to break in and shout at me, then go ahead. Or you could wait. All right, that's my problems about the substantive part, and I wrote thousands of words on this, mostly because I could, mostly because I understood it, because I'm a private lawyer with 20 years training. That's why, not because I wanted to abolish copyright. But this is the second issue which worried me, more in a capacity as an ordinary citizen, as it were, than a law professor, which is that it was noticeable, as I perhaps hinted, that throughout the course of the creation of this legislation and the passing of this legislation, there did seem to be a lot of influence by lobbyists paid by the music industry, notably the music industry, though possibly also the film and video industries. And, you know, I don't need to say this. This is an interesting quote from Lord Whitty, a Labour peer of unimpeachable character, who was involved in the House of Lords debate. And he said this. He said, "I regret to say that during the course of our consideration of the bill, we have seen one of the worst examples in my memory of the political parties being captured by a producer interest," by which he means the content industries. "This applies not only to the government, but also to the opposition front benches." And this was one of the issues, was that all three major parties had had their front benches advised by the lobbyists of the content industry. Indeed, when you went to them and talked to them, as I did, I talked at least to the Lib Dem front bench, you found out that when they didn't understand part of the bill, they were ringing up the musicians union to get advice what it meant. That's a bit like being in a criminal trial, where when the judge doesn't understand the facts, they ring the prosecutor and ask what they mean. Or ring the accused and ask what they mean, yeah? It's not exactly natural justice. So he goes on to say this is a bad bill, it's bad for the digital rights holders to press their interests in this way. When there are alternatives, that refers back to the alternative business models, the alternate compensation schemes, etc., that I discussed, which, as you can see, have no place in this bill whatsoever. And it's bad, I think the digital inclusion part, it's bad for the government to risk alienation of a very significant part of the population by enforcing these measures. And I think there has been some worry, genuinely, that we are at risk of alienating what's already a very apathetic part of the political population, which is essentially the under 25s, who notably aren't very interested in party politics and don't vote very much. And those are the people who disproportionately are generally found to be file sharing. Though some of that's urban myth too, but anyway. So, regulatory capture, that's what they're talking about. Now, on the opposite hand to regulatory capture, now this is where I turn into the sort of grassroots anthropologist that was sitting here doing this on my laptop. I was, you know, I can't say this is statistical evidence, I was sitting on my laptop basically writing and tweeting about this pretty much 24/7 for about 2 weeks, okay, for my sins. A lot of people got very involved with this in the social media, notably Twitter. Okay, how many people here are on Twitter? Yeah, fair number, but not everybody. Right. So some of you may have seen this, yeah? I think in some ways you have to be there. Twitter, obviously, is not all of the population, though you'd be surprised how many people are on these networks. I mean, certainly for Facebook, the figure currently is that something like 23 million people in this country, that's almost half of it, are on Facebook about every other day, you know? I've seen someone saying that if you want to advertise nowadays, you can get more viewers, as it were, on Twitter than by advertising in the break in Coronation Street, which is the top soap opera in this country. Now, Twitter is not quite there, but it's getting there. And I'm sorry, I don't have the absolute stats to hand, but it's zooming like that, perhaps with vertical growth. Yeah? Also, Twitter gets the older people, the literati, the influential people, so it's really quite a centre of influence. And Twitter has this thing called trending topics, Because what you can do is you can put hashtags. You can say, I'm talking about this, and you put a hashtag in front of it. So it might be like Glastonbury. I'm talking about Glastonbury. You do hash Glastonbury. Yeah? So over the course of this, it evolved that people said, I'm talking about the digital economy bill, and what they put was hash debil, D-E-B-I-L. Yeah? That hashtag, I should have put it up there, then gets canceled. Sorry? It is it. Yes, it is. It is. Right. That's the hashtag. Sorry. I'm clever as well. I'm not looking. Right. That hashtag became a trending topic, not just in the UK, but worldwide, for I think most of the 2 weeks that this was the kind of epicentre of its parliamentary progress. That's quite remarkable. I mean, you don't get very many local UK events that become trending topics worldwide, except something like the general election. We organised a campaign, and I will use we here, full disclosure, I was quite involved with the Open Rights Group in this, that involved people writing or emailing their MPs to complain about this, to ask what the MP was doing, to ask how the MP would vote, etc, etc. We ended up with, I think in the end, about 28,000 emails sent to MPs, actually. I think that figure is out of date. Now, you may not think that's that many, again, considering that there are 55, 60 million people in this country, but it's an awful lot, given political inertia. And to frame it, the example I keep using is, do you remember when the BBC said they were axing Radio 6? Mm. Yeah? Got enormous coverage in all the broadsheets on television, because the chattering classes, the media people, were very up in arms about it, right? So it's covered everywhere. People who wrote emails about Radio 6, there were 6,000 of them, right? We got about 28,000. Despite that, oddly enough, it didn't get mentioned in any major broadsheet except The Guardian until the day it passed in the Commons. And that couldn't possibly have anything to do with the fact that all the other major broadsheets are associated with the content industry, notably Rupert Murdoch's operations. So, yeah, MPs were saying, that's a direct quote, that this was their biggest postbag for many years. This was the sign of actually their constituents being interested. So you'd think that would get back to the front benches, wouldn't you? This is something people are upset about, particularly your young floating voters, and we've got an election coming up, right? But what happened... So these other two things happened. The Lib Dems were, again, all for supporting the bill, no matter what they say now. And then their own conference basically turned on them and said, this is ridiculous. The Lib Dems is quite a sophisticated, wired constituency, I think. And they said, this is nonsense. We want to preserve access to the internet. And at that point, the front bench of the Lib Dems kind of lost the plot entirely, actually, because they were just not prepared for this. So that was a real grassroots rebellion. And lots of backbench MPs, Labour, Lib Dem, Tory, you name it, we're basically getting these 100, 200 more emails per day from very upset people. And we're going to their own front benches, their own whips, whatever, and saying, what should we do? What should we do? And the whips and whatever were saying at the beginning, it'll never pass, it's okay, it'll fall before the election. So there was complete disinformation. And then latterly, they said, you've got to vote for it, it's a three-line whip. So basically, the permeation of the grassroots feeling through traditional politics was practically zero. The only change being, really, that the Lib Dem front bench was so pummeled that they decided to oppose one clause in the bill, one particular clause, but not all of it, just that one clause. And then they messed up opposing it. Sorry, I used to be a Lib Dem, but I've seen the light. Although now I've seen Nick Clegg, I might renege and vote for him anyway. Because he was kind of cute. So we ended up with the bill in wash-up, and he's better than the rest, let's face it, anyway. So we ended up with the bill in what was called wash-up, which was this couple of days before the election when they squeeze all the legislation through in about an hour with no scrutiny whatsoever, and normally that is reserved for non-controversial bills on which there is complete consensus between all the parties. I would say the digital economy bill was, and this was not just me who said this, it was the most striking example, I think, in the post-war period, of a bill that was strikingly controversial, of which there was strikingly not consensus, and yet it was pushed through wash-up by the whips. And what did people think about this? This is where it got interesting for me as the parlour anthropologist, because this is what they saw. After all these emails and all these meetings and all these people writing to their MPs, when it got to it, because it was the day before Parliament dissolved, Most of the MPs have gone home. Most of the MPs have gone back to their constituencies to start producing their flyers. Yeah. A few are left to be responsible, and that's what people saw. This is the fascinating bit. This is probably the first time that the dying days of the Parliament, this wash-up thing, have been scrutinised, both visually and in debate, via what people sometimes call the back channel. So the 2 days it had in the House of Commons, when it got like 3 hours debate when it should have had days, I don't think the MPs really realised that people were watching it on iPlayer. Thousands of people were watching it on iPlayer and on Parliament TV, and what they would see was this almost deserted Parliament with two or three people standing up and making speeches. And then lo and behold, when it got to the division for a debate, at least several hundred MPs suddenly appeared and voted. I mean, not to be too cynical, I know how it works. I mean, MPs have to go to meetings and things like that, and then they get called out when the bell sounds to go and vote. But what people saw was, they thought, a complete slap in the face by MPs ignoring their views, voting against what they said they'd do, and then not turning up. And there was this really interesting response. I mean, this shot itself comes from a site called Debilitate, which I have on the next slide. And overnight, people began putting these sites up. So this site listed the number of tweets sent, etc., as you can see, and then what it did was it named and shamed, and several sites did this in increasingly clever ways. I really take my hat off to the overnight coders. So this, you could click on your MP and you could see if they turned up and how they voted, and then you could write them an email and shout at them. And a lot of these sites went up. There was that one, there was Did Your MP Vote or something like that, and there was a lovely one called They Work for the BPI.org. Because I don't know if you've heard of the normal site that's called theyworkforyou.com, where you can write to your MP and stuff. Also, this was They Work for the BPI.org, which I must say I thought was quite funny. And it's still up. Some of these sites have gone down, but that one is still up. You can go and look. So, okay, here's the final academic point, as it were. What do I think came out of this, at least for me? I've become momentarily fascinated with it. I think it showed that there was a complete lack of understanding by almost all the politicians that were over the age of 40, i.e. most of them, as to how important the internet is. You know, and I really think that's almost an objective statement. I think they thought the internet was for sending emails to your mates and playing games and breaking the law. Whereas they didn't really realise that for a very large number of people in this country now, it is how you work, rest and play. You know, it's how you get your entertainment, it's how you get your media, it's how you talk to your boss, it's how you express your feelings. I think they completely, totally didn't get it. That was the phrase that was used over and over again. And the one or two MPs who did get it, like Tom Watson, really got it. 2 minutes?
I was just going to say it's increasingly part of healthcare as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I was going to get to that. I mean, we are now trying to roll out, as I say, all these e-services. So it's going to be that you're going to be registered with your GP online, although that's very bad for privacy and has actually been put back in its box, as far as I understand right now, until we get it right. You're going to be paying taxes online, as a lot of people already do. You're going to be claiming your benefits online. You're probably eventually going to be voting online, which is also very insecure and bad right now, but we'll get there. But that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to put it all online. So it's going to be that you do all your public, private and social activity on the internet. And really, I think a lot of the people involved in this just thought it's for playing games. I mean, there is that great line that Tony Blair didn't even get a mobile phone until he left office as Prime Minister. I've been told that one is accurate. Certainly didn't use email. Got other people to send emails for him. The second point, which is connected, is obviously that vanishingly few of, certainly the MPs, more of the Lords, which is why I like the Lords these days, understood any of the technical issues around this bill. They just thought they could wave their hands and it would be so. They didn't really understand, I think, this idea that an IP address only identified a connection, not a person. They didn't really understand what an IP address was. They didn't understand encryption. They didn't understand how easy it was to avoid these kind of controls, to use proxy servers, anything like that. They just didn't get it, right? People were telling them, but they didn't believe it. So I think, you know, there has been a tremendous loss of faith. I think, I mean, I certainly have experienced it, and I'm not under 40. As to whether these legislators are fit for purpose when dealing with, you know, the digital economy, when dealing with the technical society, when dealing with the world we're in right now. And this was, I think, classically illustrated, I don't know if anyone noticed this one, when someone leaked a letter from Stephen Timms, who was indeed the digital economy minister in charge of this bill, saying, I refer you to something about this IP address, and then he put in brackets, intellectual property address, which I think most of this audience knows is not correct. It is internet protocol. And that was widely circulated as well. And the third point I've already made is I think it showed that there was tremendous sectoral capture here of the regulators. Basically, the front benches of each party were talking to the lobbyists for the content industries, partly because the lobbyists had loads of money, but less cynically because they really believed that was the important panel. They really believed that the creative industries, as they called themselves, were going to lose money, were going to lose jobs, and that was bad for the British economy, which it was. But they didn't take into account the entire other side of the value to creativity and the economy and so forth of a free and sustainable internet, one that is reliable, doesn't go down and doesn't get disconnected. So as I say, there was this lack of understanding also, and that's what I mentioned in the previous slide, of surveillance, of the fact that the MPs themselves and the Lords before them were under scrutiny in a way that they had never, ever, ever anticipated. I mean, politics has largely been this esoteric field where, I love this quote, and some of you will know where this quote's from, yeah? That democracy has been about, every 5 years we vote to forget what we've learned. It's a quote from Doctor Who last week. But that's what democracy has been about. It's been a 5-year tick box activity. And in between, the only people who cared about politics really were the politicians and the people who wrote the columns, the policy wonks. Yeah? This idea that we can continually scrutinise our MPs and our Lords, in fact, via iPlayer, via Twitter, via the blogs, via prominent TV, has not sunk in. And I think this has been the turning point where they've realised that, you know, they don't surveil us anymore, we surveil them, as they say. So, positive aspects. Final slide. Someone put this, I think, on my blog or something, and I thought it was really interesting, actually. This is when, you know, the dying days of this fight, which really did feel like, you know, the siege of Stalingrad by now. Someone said, actually, I'm feeling positive about this. I genuinely enjoyed spending 2 evenings watching the House of Commons. I found it interesting, and I'd like to do that more. For the first time in a long time, and this is your typical description of political apathy, I'm interested and I want to get involved. And even if it means paying just a fraction of the attention we paid to this bill, that's an improvement. And I think it has politicised quite a lot of people, made them more aware of this stuff. It's made me a lot more aware. I think that is interesting and positive, and the question is how to carry it on. The next step for me has been to carry this on as an election issue, the digital economy bill, and also this point about political participation and social media. So what will we see? Will we see more single-issue campaigns like this that are carried on as fervently online as the Digital Economy Bill opposition campaign was? Will we see the decline of party politics? Because now we can check up so easily on what our individual MPs are doing. We've got theyworkforyou.com. We've got all these tools now to look at their voting patterns, what they do, how often they turn up in Parliament, all that stuff. You can watch them giving speeches or not giving speeches, etc. You can email them really easily, so much more easily than putting a stamp on a letter. And this suggestion I just throw in, because it occurred to me just at the very end of all this, people were saying, I wish I could vote for Tom Watson. This was this MP, this Labour MP, who'd been kind of the champion. He was like the people's princess. He was kind of the digeratis princess. And he's the MP for West Bromwich. And somebody said, I wish I could vote for you, Tom. And he said, well, you'll have to move to West Bromwich. And I thought, this is silly. I mean, I spend my life moving between sort of London, Edinburgh, Sheffield, where am I being lately, Manchester, Winchester. There's a lot of people like that nowadays. You know, obviously you still need local constituencies, but do we also want virtual constituencies? Or do we just want PR, which is perhaps the sensible answer to that? But that's where I'll leave it with suggestions for the future.